Hey guys, greetings from quarantine. This is just a brief pre-show note to let you know this is part one of a two-part series we're doing on the top 10 points of divergence in American history. Jason and I meant this to be a one-part episode. I don't know why we even try to do these as one-part episodes anymore, to be perfectly honest with you. We should just know that we like to talk and we get excited. But this is part one. Part two will be coming on next week. I hope you enjoy it.
We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
We don't have government of the people, by the people, for the people. We have government of the people, by the bureaucrats, for the bureaucrats.
You don't have to be a Republican or a Democrat. You can be whatever you want to be. Just go and fight for your beliefs and be as independent as you can.
So the last time we did a list episode was our top five presidents and our bottom five presidents, and that turned into a 3 or 4 part episode. I don't remember. There was a lot of material to cover, but it also was a lot of fun, and I certainly learned a lot. So I figured we'd do another one, especially, you know, with our last episode, we talked about black swans and how the response to COVID-19 makes it a black swan event, or at least a potential black swan event. And that got me thinking, well, what about other events in history? And while not everything we're going to be discussing today is a black swan, a lot of what we are going to talk about are moments that are important. And we're defining importance as things that changed America's path. And as we were thinking of these, we realized that sometimes the moments that change history aren't necessarily the ones you think about. So Jason and I have each thought of 5 events each, and we thought of 5 events each because we are 2 different people, we have 2 different perspectives, and we didn't want to just do, you know, the top 10 big ones that everyone would say, like, oh, the Civil War, the American Revolution, World War II, World War I, you know, the big things you get in any competent history class. We wanted to go a little bit deeper. So, Jason, did I miss anything about importance or anything like that?
No, I think you did a very good job of it. I think the only other thing that I would add on here, which I think is a wonderful thing that will show off our intellectual diversity, is that I approach things from a very historically minded perspective as a history teacher. You approach things from a very sociological perspective. And I think that's going to show in the differences in our lists, and especially how we look at stuff. So I'm very excited to see how this goes.
Awesome. And yeah, I'd say more of a psychological perspective, but I definitely think that if you're going to be a good psychologist, you have to understand history. I tell my students this all the time. If you're going to see where people are moving forward and where they are now, you have to understand how they got there. So before we get into our lists, Jason, I know you are drinking something this week. It is not alcoholic, but I know you are very excited to talk about it.
Oh, yes, I am very, very excited to talk about it, because anyone who knows me knows that I have a mild obsession with cream soda. And the only reason that people don't say, Jason, you have a problem with cream soda, is that I can show up to work on time. So I am drinking what I consider to be the finest cream soda I have ever tasted. And it is from a company called the Indian Wells Brewing Company. It's their special reserve old-fashioned vanilla cream soda. And this thing is it's a beast of a bottle. It's a 22-ounce bottle, which has a fancy little wax seal on top of it with some very, very rich vanilla tastes. It is absolutely fantastic. It's not for everyone. The vanilla is very strong, and you can taste a little bit of the burnt marshmallow in there, but I love this thing to death.
It's for the discerning cream soda drinker.
I'm pretentious about my cream soda. I don't deny it, but I show up to work on time, so I'm okay.
There you go. I am also not drinking something alcoholic because I've run out of alcohol and, you know, it's the weekend. But I am drinking Turkish coffee, or rather a facsimile of Turkish coffee. I got really dark roasted coffee, put it in my espresso machine with a bunch of cardamom, brewed that up, and then percolated it with some nice brown sugar. And it's the only way I will actually drink sweetened coffee. I do not generally like sweetened coffee, or I don't like putting cream in my coffee. I'd like straight coffee. But Turkish coffee is my exception, and I'm enjoying it. So now that we've gotten through what we're drinking as we discuss these events, we're going to go through in chronological order. So, Jason, do you want to take it away with your first event that you believe changed or defined American history?
Yeah, I do. So what I really wanted to focus on for my list is something that historians like to refer to as POD, points of divergence, where the nation could go in any direction depending on what happened with this certain event. So this, I feel, is the very first time in American history that there is an event that radically changes things. And that would be Shays' Rebellion. Daniel Shays was a farmer in western Massachusetts right after the Revolutionary War who was very, very unhappy with the Massachusetts government. He did not enjoy the high taxes that he was being forced to pay. He did not enjoy that these people in the western part of Massachusetts were being governed by whatever Boston told them to do. And they'd had enough of it. And so Daniel Shays and a bunch of his followers went on a rampage through most of Massachusetts. They got uncomfortably close to Boston, tarring and feathering tax collectors, destroying towns along the way that were not agreeing with what Shays thought, and overall being a hoodlum and causing a bunch of awful stuff to happen. Now, this is not the first rebellion in American history. It will not be the last rebellion in American history. But Daniel Shays' rebellion exposes a severe weakness in the American governance at the time. I wanted to say United States, but I can't say that yet. Because the Constitution was not the first form of government we had in the United States. We were under something called the Articles of Confederation. And the Articles were on purpose a very weak form of government. They had just, the Founding Fathers had just come from a very tyrannical government under King George. And so, in my personal opinion, they definitely overcorrected. They had a very weak government, almost no centralized power whatsoever. These states were essentially their own nations that said they were part of a larger body. The federal government could not levy taxes upon people, which sounds nice in theory, but sometimes those taxes go for stuff like national defense. Unless a law was unanimously agreed upon by all 13 states, it did not have the full weight of the law behind it. So if a law was passed 12 to 1, that one state could choose not to follow the law and there would not be any repercussions. Now, it works really well in some scenarios, but when there is a rebellion going on in a state, it's a really bad system of governance. The Massachusetts militia is absolutely crushed. And so Massachusetts appeals to the National Congress and says, please give us some militia members to try and defeat Daniel Shays. And the National Congress is powerless to stop the states from refusing. South Carolina and North Carolina and Georgia, the three most southern states in the Union, look at themselves and go, Massachusetts is way the heck up in the north. Why would we send our troops to go fight? That doesn't benefit us at all. And so they refuse to send troops up. Only Virginia and Pennsylvania sent troops to help Massachusetts because they're the only states that wanted to see them succeed. New York, another northern state, wanted Massachusetts to fall because they thought if Boston goes up in flames, more people will trade at the New York City harbor. The country was basically rampant anarchy for the next 6 months or so until Shays was finally defeated by Massachusetts, Pennsylvanian, and Virginian forces. And this showed a very fatal weakness in the Articles of Confederation. Because, according to the Founding Fathers, the purpose of government is to protect your natural rights. Oftentimes, the government fails to protect your natural rights because it is too powerful and it has tyranny. But there is another way that the government can fail at its purpose. If it is too weak to protect those rights, it is also failing its duty and it needs to be strengthened. And even though people had known the Articles had problems, no one was willing to do anything about it because they said, what if we go too far in towards tyranny? We don't want to take that risk. This system isn't perfect, but these people are free. Shays' Rebellion showed them, oh my goodness, this isn't working what we have going on right now. We definitely need to have some sort of convention to either alter or abolish the Articles of Confederation. If it wasn't for Shays' Rebellion, nobody would have been scared enough to go to the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia. If it wasn't for Shays' Rebellion, a very weak and ineffective government probably would have continued limping on for decades until the states decided to abolish it and go their separate ways. And you would have seen a balkanized United States of America where Britain and France and Spain and Russia are all trying to play different states against one another. So having Shays' Rebellion occur and having it be a very unifying and very scared straight sort of event is, in my opinion, the very first big point of divergence in American history.
I've heard differing accounts as to whether or not Shays' Rebellion definitely instigated the Constitutional Convention. I don't know enough to pick a side, honestly, as to whether or not that's correct.
So the reason why I say that it's correct is because in James Madison's diaries, and God bless that man for keeping such an accurate account of everything in his life, Madison mentions that he doesn't call it by name, but he says, "An uprising in Massachusetts has finally convinced my esteemed colleagues that such action is necessary." And he's definitely referring to the Shays' Rebellion when he does so.
Okay, that's a fair justification for taking that side, I think. I do think it's also interesting, though, because, you know, it's easy to call out Shays for the way in which his rebellion was held, and they were not doing it very well at all. But I think it also highlighted the dangerous nature, and I think it informs what's going to be my number one, or I guess our number two. The reasons for the dissatisfaction in Shays' Rebellion were not invalid ones, I don't think.
No, absolutely not.
Even John Adams said that he was a Federalist. He was not exactly your biggest states' rights guy, but he said that, you know, these levies were heavier than the people could bear. The Massachusetts people were being overtaxed, and there was a strong prejudice against the rural areas of Massachusetts. There was a lot of favoring towards Boston.
Oh, yes. And I want to make this very clear. Many of the founding fathers did not have any problem with Shays doing this rebellion. They had a huge problem with how he went about it. There were a lot of innocent people who died during Shays' Rebellion, and it really exposed the fact that the Articles of Confederation could not protect its own people. And they said, we need to change this. Because if we can't protect our own people, what are we doing here?
And I think that's why you saw a lot of the leaders of that rebellion, including Shays himself, get pardoned.
Yes. Daniel Shays lived until the 1830s.
Yeah, I mean, he wasn't the most popular guy, but he wasn't hanged or anything like that because he had valid criticisms. And if he'd done it in a better way, history might have gone very differently.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. But that is why it's a massive point of divergence in American history. Things changed forever because of that. Because of Shays' Rebellion, we became a United States.
Well, that leads me nicely into number two, which is mine. Another, I think, huge point of divergence, very related to yours, is the Constitutional Convention itself. That would be my number two, or our number two, my number one. We're just going to go with an hour numbering, one through ten.
There we go.
So I'll start with the constitutional ratification. Even some of the delegates who were sent there didn't think they were there to get rid of the Articles of Confederation. People had come for various and sundry reasons. Some people came because they thought they were reforming it. They were just going to reorganize it. They weren't. This was not a planned event to get rid of the Articles and create the Constitution. So there was a huge potential for divergence all over the place throughout this event that was the Constitutional Convention. And I think you see a lot of Shays' Rebellion's legacy in the convention, not just in starting it, but in the discourses that surround it. Now, obviously, I can't go into everything about it because that's its own subject. I mean, the Federalist versus Anti-Federalist papers alone are a huge part of our American literature. But the first point of divergence I would see in this is the fact that we could have tried to fix the Articles of Confederation, or we could have gone with the Constitution. That was the first one. And then there is the Anti-Federalist versus Federalist debate. What kind of system were we going to create here? And there are so many specific questions that were brought up, but I want to bring up just a few. The first would be, you know, we talk in broad terms like Federalists versus Anti-Federalists, but there was a wide spectrum of ideology even within those movements. You have James Madison, who was one of the primary writers of the Federalist Papers, especially Federalist 10, which is the big one. You know, he's a big author for the Federalists, and he has a very different idea of America than, say, Hamilton does.
Or John Adams or Ben Franklin. Any of those people?
Exactly. And you have anti-Federalists that include Sam Adams, who is very different than Thomas Jefferson. And Thomas Jefferson was, if anything, he seemed a little bit riled that he was being placed in the anti-Federalist camp. He kind of wanted to be a lane splitter like Madison and be like, you're both idiots. And I think you see that even looking through some of these issues that were brought up. So one way it could have diverged, the question of how the Constitution was going to function. You had some people like Oliver Ellsworth, he said that there should be no direct election of any federal government people whatsoever. Basically, everything, we're going to have a bicameral legislature, fine, but we're not going to have popular sovereignty as any part of the new country. Obviously, that didn't win out. You have people like Hamilton going even more oligarchical in his plan that was considered so absurd and so oligarchical and authoritarian, it was never even brought to the floor. He tried to propose it, and everyone says, no, Alexander, please sit down.
Or James Wilson, who wanted everything decided by the people themselves at the most very basic account, a wide range of stuff.
So you do have even the anti-Federalists acknowledging that there were flaws in the Articles of Confederation. The fact was that we needed a central government that could regulate trade, because we didn't have anything, and we needed actual trade arrangements to exist.
And provide a unified diplomatic voice, because what the British were doing, yes, is they were playing the states off of one another. And so you needed a unified American voice to be able to say, yes, we are doing this, or no, we are not doing that.
And you also had, you know, it's all well and good to talk about states' rights, and obviously I think states' rights are important, but the states themselves were not exactly behaving. You had a lot of state-level populism that needed to be, I don't want to say crushed, but it needed to be stopped. And so this was an ongoing debate, and it is still an ongoing debate, I think. You know, the anti-Federalists, they were right about a lot. When they talked about the dangers of government, you know, the anti-Federalist papers are nowhere near as ubiquitous in American political education as the Federalist papers are. But if you read the anti-Federalists, I think you see that a lot of their warnings were quite correct, and the compromises that they demanded from the convention were important. In the Constitutional Convention, you see the insistence of a Republican system over a purely Democratic one. You see the idea that we are one nation. This is where America starts, the idea of one nation, not just, you know, a confederacy of states. You see in this convention the idea of the checks and balances on federal power. And this, to me, is probably the biggest one, because if you do a study of constitutionalism, and I'm not saying I'm an expert on this by any means, but if you look at somebody like Father Antonio Rosmini, who was a constitutionalist, he's very influential, he's writing at about this time. And when he tries to create the perfect constitution for Italy, only a few years after America, he didn't even mention America, because what America was doing with checks and balances and the system it's created was so different than anything else that had been done that nobody really thought it would last, and nobody thought it was worthy of acknowledgement, really. And yet now it's defined modern government in a lot of ways. You also see this with the acceptance of a popular vote. A lot of people at the convention really were pushing for an even more restrictive vote.
The debate about whether to have an executive, right? The president, that was a hugely controversial thing, because the founding fathers wanted to base their government as much off of the Roman Republic as possible. And when the Roman Republic instituted a strong executive, it quickly became a Caesar, and it was, yep, a very dangerous thing.
And the presidency, again, was very, I mean, we think of presidents, and we make the comparisons to chancellors or prime ministers that we see in other modern small d democratic systems. But at the time, no one had an executive branch like we did. And how that executive branch looked, the uniqueness that for the most part endures to this day. There's been a lot of perversion of it, but it still exists in a lot of ways to this day. That was unique to this convention. It could have gone a very different way. The other big thing here for me was the Bill of Rights. Hamilton makes the argument in Federalist 84, and when I took political science in college, when I still had a very different plan for my life, that was my point of divergence. It was basically championed to me by the professor who taught me that Well, Hamilton was absolutely right. The Bill of Rights just convinced people that, you know, these were the only rights that existed. And Hamilton in general, from the federal, a lot of the Federalists in general had this idea. I think it was very naive. I'm not saying I don't understand why they held it, but I think it was there and it was naive that somehow the federal government was going to be better than state governments and it wouldn't fall prey to any of these nasty impulses they were seeing. And then you have them being forced to compromise here with people like George Mason saying, yeah, no Bill of Rights means no ratification of this Constitution. We are conditionally ratifying the Constitution with the understanding that the Bill of Rights will be on it. And if you don't give the Bill of Rights, we are revoking it.
I really do appreciate some of those men like Governor William Randolph of Virginia and Colonel Mason of Virginia, who said, we're not signing this. And they went, why the heck not? You guys helped write the thing. You're some of the first seven who agreed to it. And they said, I believe that Mason's actual line was, though I do love this country, I would sooner strike off my right hand than put it to the document as it is written now. We must have these rights and they must be enshrined for our generation and all that follow after. It's a really great moment.
Yeah, so you had all these potentials for it to go very different directions. Like this is just, this is a node point with so many sub-nodes in it for points of divergence. And what emerged was very unique, very important, not perfect. One of the books, I forget which, I read a few different books and articles to prepare for this point. I honestly can't remember which one it was who said this, but I remember the quote. And that was, nobody left the Constitutional Convention happy or satisfied, and that is why it worked. Because it was an instance of compromise. Nobody got exactly what they wanted. And with compromise, that's necessary. If everyone gets exactly what they want, it probably hasn't been a compromise. Yeah. It's been a concession. And compromise is fundamental to any sort of social change and any sort of harmonious group dynamics occurring. And that, for me, is why I put the Constitutional Convention as number two on our list of important historical moments and points of divergence. You have number three.
I have three and four, so it'll be a little bit of a clicker time here. Some of you may want to fast forward if you find my voice grating. I think our number three event has to be the Louisiana Purchase, because this changes America's personality and its destiny irreversibly. Before the Louisiana Purchase, we were still a very big country. We were easily the size of the greatest countries in Europe, but we were hemmed in by the Mississippi River on our western border, and we did not go further than that. There was a massive North American continent out in front of us that was still either controlled by the French, the Native Americans, or the Spanish. It was not our territory, and so we focused on just improving the things that we had. And then out of the blue, Napoleon, needing more money, approaches Thomas Jefferson and offers to give us the Louisiana Purchase for $15 million, which equals roughly 3 cents per acre.
You know what? That's a hell of a deal.
This has been the best trade deal in the history of the world, maybe ever. But what this does is overnight, it doubles the size of the United States. And most of that land is fertile agriculture and has a lot of natural resources. This is not some barren wasteland we are getting. This is prime real estate.
It's almost free real estate.
It's almost free real estate. And this is incredible for the United States because it helps us develop, or I should probably say refine, a couple of things that have become synonymous with America. The first thing this helps us refine is it helps us refine the American dream. Where if you work super hard in America, you will be able to succeed and prosper here because you have so much freedom to go where you want to go and do what you want to do. And before the Louisiana Purchase, there were a lot of immigrants coming into the United States with that mantra that, yes, we will be able to do what we please here. We shall be peasants no longer. But for a lot of them, they still were peasants. They were sharecroppers working for a farmer because even though there was a massive amount of land, that land was getting swallowed up and it was getting swallowed up very quickly and we were running out of room. Now you double the United States, double its land area. almost all of that land is fertile farmland where there is no one else who even has a prior claim to it. And while there are Native American tribes out there, the vast majority of the Louisiana Purchase is completely unclaimed land. Even by the Native Americans, there are huge swaths of it that settlers are allowed to come in and claim as their own. And so now, no matter whether you're a Native American, a native-born white American, or you're an immigrant from another country, you are allowed to go out and be your own person. You will be nobody's servant. You will be nobody's peasant. You can own your own slice of land. It's not guaranteed that you'll succeed, but you are able to go west and settle. No matter how bad your life was before, you get a restart, which is an essential part of the American identity and culture, something that is still very prevalent to this day. Most immigrants coming into our country, coming through our borders, are coming here at a chance of a better life. And the Louisiana Purchase is what enshrines that chance at a better life for all people. In addition, it causes a massive westward migration explosion. When Lewis and Clark return back to Washington, D.C. and give Jefferson their findings, and Jefferson finds out just how big the land is that he purchased, reports were that his face went pale and he said, "It will take us 1,000 years to settle the western coast of the United States." And that is when America collectively said, "Hold my beer, I'm doing it in 150. The rate that we exploded west is insane. And I think that a large part of that is because of the opportunity that the Louisiana Purchase gave us. The second way that this irrevocably changes the United States, and I think for the better, is it really makes us a massive industrial country and a very vital trading partner. Because the Louisiana Purchase has a lot of natural resources that are not found in such abundance in other places in the world. Not only that, but we got the port of Louisiana. We have most of the Great Plains under our control, which might not originally seem like it's that big of a deal, but this is very vital for us building those transcontinental railroads that will make it so easy for us to ship stuff from the West Coast, where we have all the raw resources like the copper and the iron and the silver, to the East Coast, where all of our manufacturing is located. If you do not have the Louisiana Purchase, you never have access to these resources. You never have the chance to build the massive, groundbreaking, sometimes literally earth-shattering infrastructure that we have. So it completely changes American history.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I can also think of two other ways I would say that it becomes a point of divergence for us. One's positive and the other one's negative. So would you rather I start with the negative or the positive?
Let's go with negative. Let's end on a good note for the Louisiana Purchase.
So, and admittedly, I'm about to sound like the most dreaded thing, a social justice warrior, but here we go. This also changes how we relate to Native American tribes.
Oh, yes.
Because even though much of it is unclaimed by specific tribes, a lot of it was claimed, but, and this is something libertarians still struggle with. Ayn Rand has some of the most heinous things she ever said in her life, and I've had them repeated back to me by devotees of her, revolve around these things. Well, they didn't have our view of land ownership, so it was right to take it from them.
They had no concept of private property, stuff like that.
Yeah, which is just, that's heinous. To say, to justify that is heinous. And we'd also, while America as a new nation had to have some dealings with Native Americans, at least some historians will say that before the westward expansion, we were kind of headed in a positive direction. We'd had several tribes ally with us in the Revolutionary War. In fact, the Iroquois Confederacy's constitution informed our own. We had decent relationships, but now we have westward expansion.
I'm one of those historians, by the way. Dartmouth College had been established to give Native Americans a chance at reading our Bible and also a chance for us to study their culture. The Northwest Ordinance, a document that predates the Constitution, talked about how just and honorably you are forced to deal with the Native Americans. But as soon as we moved out of what was considered the Northwest, meaning Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, and Michigan, they said, oh, this doesn't apply anymore.
Yeah, and so we have to have a new era beginning of Americans versus Native Americans, like America the country versus these nations who had lived here for thousands of years. And it shifted in a very negative light because Now, from their perspective, there are all these invaders. From our perspective, we bought it from France, except we were expanding into that territory in a way the French never had. And so it definitely sets the stage for later instances like the Trail of Tears, like the Indian Removal Act, and things like that, where it could have gone a different way, I think. And I wish it had, but it didn't. But in a positive light, something the Louisiana Purchase did for us was it created us as a members of the scientific community. Because while before we'd had figures like Ben Franklin, who could just go to places like Britain or France and entertain all the ladies with his beaver skin hat and his inventorish ways. He was the Doc Brown of the 18th century in a lot of ways. Yes. But we didn't have a scientific community. But I actually worked for a very long time at the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia, which was founded in part to categorize and keep Lewis and Clark's findings from their exploration of the Louisiana Purchase. I've in fact seen type specimens of things they found. It helped us create, not that we were accepted immediately, but it helped us contribute to the global scientific community. America now had things to add because there were new species, new ways of life, new life forms that were being discovered in the Louisiana Purchase and categorized and classified because we wanted to categorize them. Napoleon had only ever really been interested in the resources. So that was a positive thing, I think, that emerged from the Louisiana Purchase. I'm sure it would have emerged another way, but it was an unforeseen consequence that at that time we start entering the scientific community. So I'm ending on a positive note with that one.
Would you agree then that it's one of the most important events in American history?
I think yes. I think in ways that we don't think about, though, because we tend to think of history through lenses like wars or, you know, tons of speeches being made about a thing. But again, things that points of divergence can be small things. It's like the butterfly effect, yeah. Right? Something Ian Malcolm from Jurassic Park, chaos theory, yes. Blah, 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 blah.
Well, hey, speaking of wars being absolutely essential to the development of a nation, that brings us to our number four pick, which is, for me, the Civil War battle, the Battle of Bull Run. The Battle of Bull Run is not the most important battle in the Civil War. I may not even say it's one of the most five most important battles in the Civil War. It is, however, the most important battle for the development of America. Bull Run is the very first battle ever fought in the Civil War. Both sides had been gearing their troops up for a fight, and they were ready to go. The North was extremely cocky because they thought the South was a bunch of ragtag hillbillies that wouldn't have any real military training, even though they had all the best generals. They just didn't have the Northern technological or numerical superiority. In fact, when Lincoln called for volunteers, he wanted 150,000 volunteers, and over 250,000 people volunteered for the army in those early days of 1861. So Lincoln sent 100,000 people back home because he said, I'm just not going to need you.
Mistake.
All of Lincoln's top generals had told him, Mr. President, this war is going to be a matter of marching. When we march into the South, they will break before us like water going by a ship, and we shall kick this rotten house down. All it shall take is one swift kick to a pillar. And so they get to Bull Run, which only takes place about 20 miles outside of Washington, D.C. It was so close that there had been congressmen who went to the bluffs overlooking the battlefield and set up picnic baskets to watch the battle unfold because they didn't want to miss the action.
That happened a lot with various and sundry battles, actually, because if you go to the Gettysburg battlefield, you'll hear the same thing. Families would watch the battles. It was like,
oh, yes. Oh, yes. But see, this was even more important because people thought this will be the only battle of the war. There isn't going to be another one after this because the Union's going to kick their butt. And so the battle commences, and it does look like the Union is about to win. For probably 9/10 of the duration of that battlefield, the Union is winning, and the Confederates keep retreating and retreating and retreating until all of a sudden they don't. One Confederate general, Thomas Jackson, who earns the name Stonewall Jackson after this battle, stands there like a stone wall and tells his men no matter what comes at them, they shall hold the line. And they do. And the Union keeps sending wave after wave of men, and they keep dying. And eventually the Union starts to panic. And then some private, nobody knows who it was, said, my God, it is a trap. They have surrounded us. Run for your lives. The Confederacy had done no such thing. But the Union Army started to panic. And so in what was called the Great Helter Skelter, the Union Army completely dissolved and ran back home as fast as they could. Congressmen as well realized that the battle was over and they had to flee, leaving their picnic baskets there. So some Confederate privates celebrated their victory with bottles of fancy champagne that night. And so Lincoln has his tail between his legs after this battle. The Union Army has its tail between its legs. The Union, in general, is just beaten by this psychologically. They feel awful. This has an extraordinary effect on the Civil War going forward, because what this says is that the Civil War is not going to be a very quick war. Because even though the Union Army completely dissolves as they're fleeing back north, there are so many stinking soldiers in the Union Army that they're basically able to reform them, and the Confederacy isn't able to take advantage of the situation and march to D.C. And so the war is not going to be over quickly, and everyone realizes after this it's going to be bloody. Nobody knows how many years it will be, but it will be years, not months or weeks.
At least from my reading of history, that is also the conclusion reached by the South as well. Like, they weren't particularly pleased by these results because they paid a heavy price for the victory, and they didn't have as many people as the North, and they knew it. And so to them, it indicated, you know, this is the long haul for us as well. And there were a number, you know, everyone remembers now Jackson and his, you know, I mean, Jackson's tactics are still taught. He was a revolutionary leader. But at the time, he actually didn't get much special recognition. What they were more focusing on were their own mistakes. This is where what we now think of as the Confederate flag, much lauded by high reactance people.
And tiki torch bearing individuals in South Carolina, all of those people.
Yeah, people who think mayonnaise is a spice.
Yep.
This is where that flag gets adopted, because before they'd been using the stars and bars. And that, when you're panicked and running and there's black powder smoke everywhere, that looks a lot like the American flag. And that had caused a lot of confusion. So the South wasn't exactly happy with this either, because they'd also been kind of laboring under the delusion that as long as they showed a good forward offense, they'd be able to bully Lincoln into allowing them to go free, and that wasn't what happened.
It's the Civil War is the first modern war, a post-industrial war that's being fought. And the lessons that we learned in the Civil War, that chivalry will not carry the day, a glorious charge across the battlefield will not result in victory, these are all lessons we learned by the year 1865. So in the year 1914, when Europe is making all of those mistakes, the Americans are chuckling to themselves going, you idiots.
Well, yeah, because you start in the early 1860s with Napoleonic tactics being used, except you now everyone has a rifle, so it can shoot three times as far as a previous musket with an unrifled barrel. So you start with troops lining up, you know, almost point blank range and just blitzing into each other. The war ends with people like Grant figuring out that trench warfare is going to be a thing. So it's really no small wonder that when World War I comes around and we get involved, our troops are just jumping into trenches with shotguns and making the Germans go, well, that's not fair. That is unsporting.
There is a reason why it only takes the Americans 8 months to clean up World War I. And the Europeans, despite all of the various advantages and disadvantages the sides possessed, couldn't get more than 40 miles of territory won during 4 years of warfare. And the Americans come in and mop it up within 8 months. Bull Run is a large part of that because it creates an extended war. There are two other things that I want to talk about, though, that only happen because Bull Run makes people realize it's going to be a long war. Number one, America becomes an industrial powerhouse. Not saying that we didn't have a manufacturing capability beforehand, but before the Civil War, we were a very agrarian nation. Farming is what people did. 90% of our entire population was farmers. That was just what people did back then. But they're starting to realize during the Civil War that it's not going to be, like we talked about previously, it's not going to be a cunning strategy that wins us this thing. It's not going to be a glorious charge. The way we are going to win this war is if we have more guns, more bullets, and more men. We are going to bury the Confederacy under a tide of supplies. That's how we'll win this war. And so the Union dramatically boosted its manufacturing capabilities. One of the ones that people don't think about, but this was invented because of the Civil War, is t-shirt sizes. Most people would go in, especially for something like a uniform, for tailoring, or they would patch it up on the army trail, right? But it was always custom measured, and they would get these measurements, they'd send it back, and the person would make the shirt by hand. Right? Or even with the machine still using that size, they realize that with the amount of shirts they're going through in the Civil War, not just from battlefield stuff, but general wear and tear of the army, they cannot afford to have that outdated system. And so what they realize is that you can pretty much categorize people into one of three different categories: small, medium, or large. And everyone will kind of fit in one of those three shirts. And so you make small, medium, and large, make a buttload of them so you don't have to have a per order sort of distribution thing. And voila, we have clothing sizes that are made. And this is something that after the Civil War, a lot of these companies who were created to make shirts for the army realize, I can make just as much, if not more money, making shirts for civilians now that this is all over.
Yeah.
Our steel industry, which created all of our ironclad battleships, that created all of the musket balls that we had. That steelmaking industry doesn't go away after the Civil War. It keeps on producing the same volume of stuff it used to, but now it's for civilian usage. Here's a stat for you. So before the Civil War, in terms of the strength and size of our economy measured by how much stuff we produce each year, and the level of our industrialization, before the Civil War, we're ranked 20th. After the Civil War, 4 years later, we're ranked number 4. And it only takes us 20 more years to reach number 1. And by the time the year 1900 rolls around, right? What is that?
35 years
after the Civil War, right? Number 2 isn't even close to us. And that only happens because of the industrialization that occurs during the Civil War that we keep with us afterwards. If Bull Run had been a Union victory and they'd gone down south and the rebellion of 61 had been ended in a couple of months, you would never have had the need for this mass industrialization. I'm not saying that there wouldn't have been industrialization, but it definitely wouldn't have been at the scale that we had after the Civil War. The last thing that I want to talk about here is the fact that the Union loses the Battle of Bull Run means that the slaves are freed. During the early parts of the Civil War, Lincoln was adamant that he is here to protect and preserve the Union, not free slaves. There's that quote that we talked about during our presidential discussion, right? Where he said, if I could save the Union by freeing all slaves, I would. If I could save the Union by freeing none of the slaves, I would. Because that was Lincoln's primary goal, is to save the Union. And he was very ready to protect and preserve the United States by telling the South, after they had marched down and destroyed them, that, look, we understand that this happened. Why don't you come back into the Union? I guarantee you that slavery isn't going to be touched if you come back peacefully. That would have happened. Lincoln even admitted that it would have happened. But we lost at Bull Run. And the war was a long war. And the long war allowed for Lincoln to give a moral purpose for the war. It allowed for Lincoln to free these slaves because there was no way the South was coming back peacefully. They were going to be conquered, essentially. And so Lincoln was able to impose the Emancipation Proclamation and the 13th Amendment on these states. So if it had not been for a loss at the Battle of Bull Run, the Union would not have freed its slaves. At least not that quickly, and we probably would have had 20 to 30 more years of slavery.
We also talked about this a little bit with the Civil War. What was it, a two-parter or three-parter, whenever we did that, how much that the Civil War became a part of the American identity and remains a part of the American identity. And a lot of the problems, I think you could make the case, at least from what you're saying, I would make the case, it all does stem back to Bull Run. This is no longer just a brief disagreement, nor is it mostly political. It's also, you know, it's the first real first world country to have a civil war in the modern era, at least a long, brutal, involving total warfare tactics, civil war. And yeah, I think from what you're saying, it is Bull Run that makes that happen. So ultimately, you can trace the entire legacy of the Civil War and the issues we are dealing with, even to this day, back to Bull Run.
But it's so ironic, though, because Bull Run isn't even close to the most important battle for the war itself. It was never going to be decided that way, as we understand now. Gettysburg was more important. Vicksburg, Antietam, Cold Harbor, the Wilderness, all of these were crucial in determining how the war was specifically run. But as far as American history goes and the points of divergence, there is nothing greater than Bull Run when it comes to the Civil War era.
Well, I would never have thought to identify Bull Run that way, but you've got me convinced.
Hey, that's why I get paid the not so big bucks, Aaron.
And that just about does it for part one of our two-part series on points of divergence in American history. Be sure to check back next week for the conclusion of that series. Otherwise, take care of yourselves, stay healthy, stay sane in quarantine. We'll talk to you soon. Thanks for listening to the Life, Liberty, and Pursuit of Snarkiness podcast. If you like what you heard, please consider giving us a like or a share on social media, or leaving us a review on the podcasting platform of your choice. You can reach us at our Facebook at Liberty Snark, or visit our website at libertysnarkpodcast.com. Thank you guys so, so much for listening.